I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The New York Times writes today that the road to the White House has become a cliff walk for candidate Hillary Clinton. Republican presidential frontrunner John McCain took some conservative voters away from Mike Huckabee in yesterday's primaries. But Barack Obama made significant inroads into Senator Hillary Clinton's core support, white women and union members. In a moment, we'll profile Senator Obama in our continuing series on the candidates. But first, we turn to Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. And Rick, you're pretty blunt. You write on the ABC News political blog, The Note, that the sound that Clinton heard while rushing out of Wisconsin after yesterday's primaries was the crashing down of her last pillars of stalwart support. What did you mean?
Well, I think she's been able to count on a couple of key demographics to come through for her. And basically, in the early primaries, she saw white voters flock to her, particularly white women, lower-income voters, less educated voters, union households. All of those groups are trending toward Obama. He didn't win them all, but he cut deeply into her support in all of them, and it meant that the support that he had in the past among some upper-income voters, among particularly African-American voters, that combined with the inroads he made against Clinton's groups meant that he's won just a series of overpowering victories, 17 points yesterday in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a state that demographically really favored the Clinton campaign. It's an overwhelmingly white state. It's blue-collar, a lot of union households, a lot of union Democrats, but really, Barack Obama blew past her in a state that Hillary Clinton desperately would have liked to have won.
Well, what is the math now, Rick? March 4th, two delegate-rich states, Ohio and Texas, will hold their primaries, states she hopes to do well in. Can she still win with state delegates, not the freelance superdelegates who can switch their support, but the state delegates? Can she still mathematically win with them going into this summer's convention, or has Barack Obama made that impossible?
Mathematically, it's possible, but it is increasingly difficult. She'd have to win with overwhelming margin. She's fallen now behind in the delegate race by almost 100 delegates by our count. That includes the so-called unpledged delegates, superdelegates. So If you net them out of the equation, she's down 150, maybe 200 delegates on the actual pledged front. And that means she'd have to win not just Texas and Ohio narrowly. She couldn't win 51-49. She'd have to win something like 60-40, maybe 70-30 to begin to make serious inroads into the delegate count. That's a very difficult thing to do. Barack Obama hasn't lost states overwhelmingly like Hillary Clinton has. So she'd have to not just slow his momentum and overtake him, but really begin to lap him.
Which is why we should say states like Rhode Island, which also have their primary, which, you know, would never have considered themselves a factor before, a small state with few delegates, they're now equally important because every delegate counts.
Well, every delegate does count, but the problem is that because Democrats allocate them proportionally, if you win 50% or 51% of the vote, you only win half the delegates. So it becomes very hard to make up lost ground.
John McCain, the presumptive Republican nominee, said this morning on Good Morning America that he still feels that Hillary Clinton is a threat as a candidate. But last night in his speech after the primaries, he, without naming Barack Obama, directly attacked him, called his words of rhetoric eloquent but empty, questioned his stance on foreign policy. Are we seeing a taste of what John McCain believes the general election might be like?
I think two things are going on. One is Barack Obama clearly is in a better position right now than Hillary Clinton to win the Democratic nomination. The other factor in John McCain's mind, a lot of Republicans' mind, is that they privately are a lot more afraid of Barack Obama than they are of Hillary Clinton. They view Hillary Clinton as a known quantity, someone who's been defined by the public. Barack Obama changes the political map. He presents a fresh challenge. In some ways, it's more of a risk for Democrats as well. But because he's such an unknown quantity, the McCain campaign doesn't want to waste any time, even this time now when the Democrats are still fighting it out. They don't want to waste a single second or a single news cycle in not trying to define him aggressively. So that's why we heard Senator McCain come out very strong against Senator Obama last night.
Is that why Barack Obama might be forced in the coming days to talk more about issues than perhaps he has been in the past?
This is a tough time for him as well. I mean, he's got now a solid 2 weeks where Senator Clinton is going to be throwing everything she can at him, and Senator McCain will be doing the same thing. So he's never really faced this kind of aggressive, full-on, full-throated scrutiny and criticism from multiple fronts. He's now going to get it from both Democrats and Republicans. This will be a key test for him. Obviously, the Obama campaign would obviously like to wrap up the nomination as much as possible. They also realize that his biggest strength as a candidate is his ability to rise above the fray. So they don't want to have him too mixed up in the down and dirty, nitty-gritty details of politics, but he is going to be severely tested over these next 2 weeks.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, how will Barack Obama handle the next 2 weeks? It might help to look back. Today we're going to continue our candidates' profiles. Last week, Arizona Senator John McCain, former POW, rebellious son of a Navy admiral, and an indomitable 95-year-old mother who still campaigns with him. Still to come, New York Senator Hillary Clinton, daughter of the Midwest and a former First Lady. And today, Illinois Senator Barack Obama, biracial son of a Kenyan and a Kansan. He rose from Chicago community activist to U.S. Senator to now front-runner for the Democratic presidential nomination. His backers say he's the new John Kennedy. But as we just heard Rick Klein say, his critics say he's all hat, no cattle. Well, Karen Tumulty is senior political correspondent for Time magazine. She's written cover stories on the candidate, and she joins us now for a profile. Karen, welcome back to Here and Now.
Well, thank you very much.
And I want to go back because in December, in one of your articles, you reminded us that in Barack Obama's first Democratic debate, he botched a question on terrorism. The candidates were asked how they'd respond to a domestic attack. Hillary Clinton said, retaliate, hunt the attackers down. Obama said what?
It was a really odd response about how he would check into disaster preparedness. He really sounded much more like somebody who was running to be the head of FEMA than the commander-in-chief.
Or, as you write, a candidate for the volunteer fire department.
Right.
But you also remind us that back in the beginning, thousands would turn out to hear Barack Obama. Many first knew of him from the last Democratic convention, inspired by him then, but they would leave feeling oddly underwhelmed. When did that change? When did a switch obviously throw for him?
You know, I think it was in the fall, and I think there is one moment that you can point to very, very specifically, and that was a dinner in Iowa. It's part of a sort of run-up to the caucuses called the Jefferson-Jackson Dinner. And Obama had brought in a lot of supporters from out of state, young people, and he walked on stage and just electrified.
In fact, we have a little bit of that. Let's listen.
The party of Jefferson and Jackson, of Roosevelt and Kennedy, has always made the biggest difference in the lives of the American people when we led not by polls, but by principle. Not by calculation, but by conviction. When we summoned the entire nation to a common purpose, a higher purpose.
Barack Obama speaking at the Jefferson-Jackson dinner. So there was this, as you say, electricity. But, of course, there's also been criticism that there is just that electricity, that he's not been asked about the issues. He has recently been talking more about jobs and the economy as he goes into the blue-collar, formerly Clinton territory. But as you know, Obama in the past has said he'd consider U.S. military action in Pakistan to target terrorists. He said the U.S. should try talking to Iran. Last night, John McCain, without naming Obama, ridiculed those positions. How do you think issues are going to factor into his campaign from here on out?
Well, I think that there is, in fact, going to be a lot of pressure on him to bring a lot more substance to bear, along with the soaring rhetoric. And, you know, this is a problem that has been there all along since the campaign began.
You mentioned a video that's all over YouTube.
That's right. There is a video of a Barack Obama supporter, a Texas state senator, being asked on TV by Chris Matthews on Hardball to name a single legislative accomplishment of Barack Obama's. And as the state senator stumbles for an answer, finally he just says, well, you know, that's not what is important. So this is something, of course, that the Clinton campaign has absolutely jumped upon. And like I said, it's all over YouTube. Of course, you know, the problem for them is that, you know, Hillary Clinton herself, though she's been in the Senate for 4 years longer than Barack Obama, also does not have any kind of big signature legislative achievement to her name. And both of them, quite frankly, have been MIA from some of the biggest debates that have been going on in the Senate this year.
Staying with Barack Obama, because Hillary Clinton will be to come. David Brooks, a conservative columnist, wrote in the New York Times yesterday, also with a number of questions he said he had about Barack Obama. Why didn't he join the 68 senators who worked out a bipartisan deal on FISA? Why did he opt out of parts of a Kennedy-McCain bill on immigration that would have upset unions? So those questions are starting. But, you know, as you say, his story has so electrified people. Let's talk a little bit more about that. His mother, a free-spirited white woman from Kansas who moved to Hawaii, where she married a Kenyan studying there. Barack, born in 1961, but his parents divorced when he was two. What does Barack Obama say the impact of that abandonment by his father on his life has been?
Long before he went into politics, he wrote a really extraordinary autobiography about his search for some sort of relationship with his father, which also brought him into a search for his identity. And this was, you know, a young man of mixed race who grew up in a largely white environment, except for a stint living overseas in Indonesia, went to a very, very elite prep school in Hawaii on scholarship. And really not until he was a young man in you know, college age, really, did he begin to connect with his African-American identity. And I think that, you know, it really is a story that has resonated, and, for instance, has put this book on the bestseller list in, you know, an increasingly multicultural culture that we're living in.
He was a young man in search of a father. He had a stepfather, an Indonesian Muslim who was loving, but that second marriage of his mother's failed as well. He was raised by maternal grandparents when he went back to that elite school in Hawaii. But Todd Purnham in Vanity Fair tracked down some of his friends from those times at that elite school, and they dispute Obama's account of being, you know, angry about his biracial identity and racism when he was one of the few blacks in high school in Hawaii. That doesn't mean he didn't have internal feelings about it, but they say he never talked about those issues.
That's right, and he was always, you know, someone who excelled in these environments. In fact, he became the first African-American editor of the Harvard Law Review.
You mentioned Harvard Law. It feels as if, you know, he'd been to Columbia before that. It feels as if at Harvard Law, he also made some self-discoveries and a huge transitions happened for him.
That's right, and so you look at what he did after law school, and certainly, you know, just about any opportunity would have been open to him at that time, and he did, in fact, go to work for a law firm in Chicago, but he found his way into community organizing, and I think that this is where really Barack Obama comes full circle and, you know, really finds the, you know, identity that was sort of denied him in the unique circumstances of his upbringing. And it is really where, in a lot of ways, you see much more of the Barack Obama that you actually see out on the campaign trail today.
Karen Tumulty, senior political correspondent for Time magazine and author of their cover story on Barack Obama. When we come back, what happened in Chicago? Also, if Barack Obama's words are eloquent, will his wife's words create a problem? And remember those false emails that claimed that he was a Muslim? Well, Barack Obama is a Christian, but why is his church so controversial? We'll have more on Barack Obama. Also later, the falling dollar, bad for American tourists abroad, but good for American business abroad. Find out why. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with Time Magazine's Karen Tumulty, continuing our profile of Barack Obama. Before the break, Karen was talking about how Barack Obama came into his own in Chicago, beginning as a neighborhood organizer. Let's pick up there, Karen. Obama has a reputation for real political toughness in Chicago after his community organizing. He won his first race in 1996 by contesting the petition signatures of his opponents and effectively getting them off the ballot.
Well, and this is, of course, a man who titled his second book "The Audacity of Hope." And as much as people talk about hope when they talk about Barack Obama, I think the audacity is there in equal measure.
But what about some of the questions about Barack Obama's allegiances in Chicago? For instance, his ties to a slumlord.
Tony Rezko was a figure who was very, very powerful in Chicago politics. And, you know, has been accused of influence buying, but, you know, and was, in fact, a political and financial patron for Barack Obama. And in what Obama himself says is his greatest lapse of judgment, the two of them got involved in a real estate deal when Obama was buying his house, where Rezko bought property next to it. Now, just in the last few days, stories have come out where the people who sold the house said that Obama did not in fact, get any special deal on this. He was the highest bidder for the house, so he got it.
Conservatives have also been raising questions about Barack Obama's church. This is the Trinity United Church of Christ, very Afrocentric. Its pastor, Reverend Jeremiah A. Wright Jr., a controversial figure, an admirer of the Nation of Islam's Reverend Louis Farrakhan, for instance. And reports are saying that the Obama campaign is keeping that pastor under wraps.
It is sort of significant because Obama does speak a lot about his faith, but he does not go into the specifics of where this church and this pastor stand. But you can bet that the Republicans will be bringing this up if, in fact, he does get the nomination.
Why? What is the criticism?
They are going to look, for instance, at National Journal's ranking of Obama as the most liberal senator in the Senate. You know, they are going to look at comments that Michelle Obama has made. I mean, all these things are going to be aimed at kind of convincing swing voters and independents in particular that this is a candidate who is out of the mainstream.
Let's pick up on Michelle Obama's comments. She's being criticized for saying of voting results, you know, her husband doing so well, that for the first time she's really proud of her country. Cindy McCain, who we don't often hear from, said last night that she, in fact, is always proud of her country. How are Michelle Obama's comments, going to be viewed?
I think these comments are actually very damaging, and they're an easy target. And this is a man who's running in the heartland of America. I'm really surprised that a campaign that has been so skillful with its message so far has not done anything either to clarify those comments or to take them back. And, you know, the longer they stay out there, the harder it's going to be to do.
So potentially a problem with Barack Obama's wife's words. But let's go back to his, because for his fervent followers, his rhetoric seems to override all other questions. How powerful a tool is that for him?
Extremely powerful. And these rallies, the crowds almost get swept away in this. A lot of politicians, you know, don't do well in big crowds, but you get a small, intimate gathering and they can really connect with people. With Obama, it's the opposite. It's like the bigger the crowd, the more energy he draws from them. And in fact, the least impressive performances I've seen of his have been in smaller gatherings. He really does sort of absorb the energy of the crowd, and it sort of becomes part of him. This whole line, you know, we are the change we have been waiting for, I think sort of sums it up.
We've been talking about some of these tripwires that candidates, you know, face as they gingerly walk down the road to the White House, a spouse's comments, past records. Let's talk a little bit more about the issues. Barack Obama has said he would withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq in phases, set a date to send a signal that the U.S. is serious. He's against gay marriage but for civil unions. He'd make insurance mandatory for all children but not adults, and institute an amnesty program for illegal immigrants, but only after border security is set. One of the big criticisms has been that he seems passive as a politician. The Chicago Tribune pointed out how many times he voted present in the Illinois legislature. In other words, didn't cast a vote. Obama says that's accepted practice in Illinois. But when he's scrutinized as somebody who doesn't seem to get sweaty, you know, at work, what's the sense of that?
You know, I had heard that almost from the beginning from some of his Senate colleagues. You know, he arrives at the Senate with enormous celebrity and having made it just this gigantic splash at the 2004 Democratic Convention. And so, of course, his Senate colleagues were immediately thinking, well, this is the guy we're going to put out front and center as our, you know, brilliant, charismatic spokesman on so many issues. Obama, perhaps wisely, because he was a junior senator, really held back and got involved in relatively few things, one of which, by the way, was lobbying reform, which was a very, very hot issue amid all the corruption and the scandals that we've seen coming out of Congress in the last few years. And in fact, he was a lead off of that bill. But other than that, he really did not take much of a lead role on, well, anything. You know, you do have to wonder, and I'm sure the case will be made by his opponents, that this was a guy who was worrying more about his own political viability than affecting this great change that he talks about so much.
And what does he mean by change?
He talks about it as changing the system and changing the nature of dialogue in Washington. It is not a sort of programmatic kind of change. I'll do this on this issue and that on that issue, so much as it is saying, and again, this is resonating, that, you know, Washington itself is broken, and that by breaking away from kind of the traditional and increasingly calcified, you know, dynamic between the two parties, you can get people in a position where they're willing to you work together instead of tearing each other apart all the time.
But it's kind of an amorphous thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Karen Tumulty, senior political correspondent for Time Magazine, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Amorphous, but touching people. Well, still ahead today, scientists tag animals to track their migration. Now they're looking to tag asteroids to keep them from hitting Earth. That's still to come. After the news, here and now. Model Gisele Bündchen is rumored to have demanded payment in euros. OPEC is considering whether it should price oil in euros instead of dollars. And some luxury condos in Manhattan are being marketed specifically to wealthy people in Ireland. Essentially, as one financial analyst recently said, America is on sale because the value of the U.S. dollar has been sliding dramatically, dropping 40% since 2002, hitting a 35-year low just before Christmas. But is there a flip side to the weak dollar? In a moment, we're going to speak with an American businessman who's riding the wave of the weak dollar. But first, joining us here in the studio, Professor Michael Goldstein, who teaches finance at Babson College. Professor, the value of the dollar is, you know, is what countries think it's worth, but does anyone formally set the foreign exchange rates? Is it done by some sort of international agreement?
Not so much an international agreement. It's just that's what people are willing to pay for a dollar at this point in time. Right now, Americans who are saying it's too expensive to go to Europe, so I'm not going, and therefore I'm not going to go over there and sell my dollars and buy euro.
Because the euro is worth what to the dollar right now,
it's
approximately?
About $1.47 per euro.
Yeah. And how did this happen? Because it used to be, you know, that the dollar was the almighty. You could go to Europe and buy so much more because the dollar was worth more than the euros.
For those with very long memories, at the end of World War II, we had all the money, we had all the people. Over time, we were still the really strongest capitalist nation in the world. And although we still are now, other countries have caught up.
And what else is a factor in the falling dollar now? Why is it that the dollar is worth so much less?
Well, since 2002, for example, why is it worth so much less? A variety of reasons. One is, for example, people in Europe would like to buy treasury bills or treasury bonds or stocks or other financial assets to invest in the United States to make money. Right now, we've really cut our interest rates, so it's not such a good deal to buy American bonds. You aren't getting such a good return, and I'd rather buy a European bond than a U.S. bond.
Because the interest rates are low, so you don't make as much money.
That's right. It's the same problem that our seniors are having right now. If they're trying to save and they're putting their money away and getting 3% return on their CDs, I think they're kind of thinking, that's not a very good deal. Well, people in Germany and Italy and Japan are looking and saying, in the U.S., you're only getting 3%. I don't want that. So I'm not going to go put my money in the U.S. They are selling their U.S. dollar stuff and buying euros.
Right. So it becomes a vicious cycle, but vicious enough to make Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez right? He recently said the empire of the dollar is crumbling.
It's probably true in the long run that we're going to have other currencies besides the dollar become important on the world stage. I think some might argue this is a long-run success for the United States, that more of the rest of the world has become capitalistic, it's become economically successful. Sometimes it's a success story when other countries around the world are also becoming successful.
Well, so given all this, the diminished dollar that we have now that's, you know, in part because of our economy, the housing crisis and things like that, what's the good news about a weak dollar?
Not a lot of great news unless you're an exporter. If you're an exporter and you're making everything in the United States, so your costs are based in dollars in the U.S., if the dollar becomes weak, it actually means that you can sell your stuff for cheaper than the people in Germany.
Aha. Enter Sandy von Stackelberg, who has been waiting on the line. He's director of international sales with the medical device maker Hydrocision. They're based in Billerica, Massachusetts. And he joins us now with this part of the story. Sandy, first of all, let's describe your product in layman's terms, surgical devices that
We call it the spine jet.
Yeah, shoot water into degenerated discs in the spine.
That's exactly right. And we sell through what we call stocking distributors. These are distributors that buy our product and stock it and then sell it onward to foreign hospitals in country. The distributors buy our products in dollars.
Are you finding that the weak dollar is enabling you to sell more of your product overseas?
Absolutely. And let me give you an example. The exchange rate goes up from, for instance, what it was back in December, say, of 2005. Our product will become more expensive in euros. As an example, at that time in December 2005, Europeans could buy our product for about 0.85 euros to the dollar, which is high. Now they can buy the same product for 0.67 euros, which is a 26% discount. And that's pretty good for them.
Can I jump in for a
second? Yeah, please.
So, for example, that means if it cost 100 euros back in December 2005, now it will only cost the people in Europe about 74 euros.
That's correct.
And his competitors, who are based in Europe, still would probably be pricing it at 100 euros, and he can gain market share because he is basically having a 26% off sale due to the weak dollar.
Well, and we're hearing that this is happening across the board, at least here in Massachusetts, where we checked. The Associated Industries of Massachusetts told us that Massachusetts exports are up 5% worldwide. It's mainly to Canada and Europe because of the weak dollar. So, Sandy, are your fellow business people saying the same thing?
Absolutely. And the only concern I have with this is that, the pendulum swings back. And somewhere along the line, my product is going to become more expensive if it's denominated in dollars, which it will be. And I'm going to have to deal with that problem at that time.
But here's another question, though. Let's say, okay, you increase your sales. That means you also have to increase your production. Now, if your production is here, do you get into a little bit of a bind because it's more expensive to do that here?
Yes, and let me explain that. I guess conversely, the raw materials that may be bought overseas in dollars may become more expensive here. So some of our products use, as an example, plastic. And as you know, the cost of oil has gone up.
Right, so here you are having to ship more stuff.
That's exactly right. So here the manufacturing costs and the products have impacted what we call our costs of goods sold. And as they rise, our margin or profit drops. So this is a concern, and that has to be managed as well.
Michael Goldstein, again, you teach finance at Babson College. What would you say to business people like Sandy and others as they navigate this?
Well, I think Sandy said it well in putting it more colloquially. If you live by the dollar, you die by the dollar. There's the problem that, currency will get strong again someday, so he has to be careful about how much he wants to invest in the distributorship overseas. How many people should he hire now? The good news about a weaker dollar is if he can produce more, he can hire more people, and that's good. We need to have more employment. But when the dollar goes the other way and gets strong again, is he going to have to lay those people off? This adds additional volatility to his business. I bet the long run it's worth it, but there are some industries where they won't be able to take advantage of the weaker dollar. I mean, some industries have kind of left the United States shores for forever, and even though it now is cheaper and we can sell better, we're not going to get really the major textile industries back. In Massachusetts, we're not going to all of a sudden start making shoes again like we did. And unfortunately, probably for the Detroit and Michigan area, although it will help GM and Ford to be able to sell cars internationally, in the end, there are just larger global economic trends that you can't overcome with a weaker dollar.
Sandy von Stackelberg, again, Director of International Sales with the medical device maker Hydrocision, and Michael Goldstein, who teaches finance at Babson College. I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Click ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, are college students spending too much time in the gym? We'll meet a young woman who needed help to get over what kids are calling gymorexia. And also Thriller turns 25, but Michael Jackson's album is ageless. Even lizards are dancing to it. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Busy skies today. The shuttle has landed, but the Pentagon now says rough seas could delay a U.S. naval ship from launching a missile at that falling spy satellite until tomorrow. President Bush says the satellite must be destroyed before it crashes because it has toxic fuel, but Russian officials say that the operation could be a cover to test a new space weapon. Meanwhile, space enthusiasts are keeping an eye on another heavenly body that could hit Earth. Asteroids. Bruce Betts of the Planetary Society is leading the Apophis mission project. That's a competition to track an asteroid as it approaches Earth. And he joins us now from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
The Apophis mission. Apophis, what's that?
Apophis is an asteroid. It's about 300 or 400 meters in diameter. It is of interest because it will have a close flyby of Earth in 2029, mm-hmm. closer than our geosynchronous satellites, and visible from the surface of the Earth. But then if it hits just the right or wrong few hundred meter spot as it passes by Earth, it will actually come back and hit the Earth in 2036. Now, the good news is this is roughly a 1 in 50,000 chance right at the moment.
Yes, but we know when asteroids have hit the Earth in the past, there have been major problems.
Yes, that's for sure. Just little things like 70% of the species on Earth going extinct 65 million years ago. Now, that turned out to be good news for humans because it got rid of those pesky dinosaurs and such, but it would be kind of a drag for us if it happened now.
Well, now you have the Apophis mission design competition. What are you looking for?
It's always important to know not only that an asteroid's out there, but of course, you know, does it have Earth's name on it? Is it going to hit us? In the case of Apophis, it's particularly tricky, and so we put out an open call for proposals from students, professionals, anyone, about how one would tag the asteroid. In other words, use a spacecraft to better determine its orbit so you would really know far enough ahead if it were in danger of hitting Earth so you could make a decision to develop some type of mitigation, some type of deflection system to take care of it.
Sort of like tagging, migrating birds to make sure you know their path.
Exactly.
Something like that.
Something like that.
What else are you hoping to do?
We're also hoping to, just through this competition, generate interest in the NEO threat in general.
The NEO threat?
I'm sorry. Yes, the NEO threat. Near-Earth objects, I apologize.
No problem.
NEOs are out there, and as we know, 100 years ago, there was an object that hit over Siberia called the Tunguska event. And if that had hit in an urban area or hit in an ocean, it would have caused truly a large natural disaster, not wiping out species, but comparable to tsunamis or giant hurricanes.
That fireball leveled 2,000 square miles of a Siberian forest.
Unfortunately, it only strongly affected some reindeer and other animals, but it was witnessed by humans. But that's the kind of impact that occurs perhaps every 100 to every 1,000 years. The interesting thing about NEO threat is it's the one natural disaster that we could actually prevent. If we have enough warning, we can actually develop ways to alter the orbit of an asteroid.
Well, we know you've heard from aerospace companies, design students, professionals, and amateurs, and that you're going to announce the winner on February 26th. But tell us more about some of the entries. Are there some that are just so wacky, but wow, you know, really inventive?
There are certainly ones that are wacky, even more so in people who didn't submit a formal proposal but were sharing their ideas.
Like what?
Oh, cover the asteroid with paintballs, and then you'll increase the reflectivity and be able to see it better. Not that practical in that case. But there are others that are actually in the competition that are very innovative, some in very overt ways. I mean, trying to put sensor nets that wrap around the asteroid, to ones that are just inventive in a very technical sort of way, and so still innovative, but wouldn't be obviously innovative from the outside.
How much do you worry about what might happen?
Well, I don't lose sleep over it. Let's put it that way.
I was going to ask that because I was wondering if you worry more than the average citizen who might not think at all about asteroids hitting, or you worry less because at least you're planning on trying to track them.
Any given day, it's pretty darn low probability that you're going to have a problem. But if you take 100 years, that probability becomes non-trivial, and so I'm not sure it's worry, but focus on trying to do something about, again, this preventable natural disaster.
Bruce Betts is Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. He's been telling us about the Apophis Mission Design Competition. If you want to learn more, go to our website, here-now.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And coming up, author Russell Banks on his new book. And book critics, how can a review call something the greatest thing ever written and another say that it's, well, not, if it's the same book? In 1 minute, here and now. In writing Place as Character, think Faulkner's South, Willa Cather's Great Plains, or Russell Banks' Upstate New York, specifically in his new novel, Upstate New York on the Brink of World War II, in the midst of the Great Depression, the moneyed class motoring to their homes in the Adirondacks, where those newfangled white-slatted chairs of the same name are just becoming popular, the working class serving them. Into this mix, Russell has stirred accidental deaths, the Spanish-American War, the Hindenburg, and a Hudson River School artist named Jordan Groves.
It was a cool, cloudless morning, the air so dry it felt like all the moisture had been wrung from it. What Jordan enjoyed calling a perfect Adirondack day, referring not to the season or the temperature, but to the brilliant light. Winter or summer, on days like this, under a cobalt blue sky, everything in his sight was sharply detailed, as if etched with acid, making him feel he could see and touch each and every leaf on each and every tree, every patch of lichen on every rock, every boulder glistening in the stream.
The book is The Reserve, and author Russell Banks joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to ask you about Upstate New York as place, because many people around the country have the same feeling that they just know by smell and taste where they are. Mm-hmm. I know when I cross from the Massachusetts Turnpike into New York, I know I'm in New York and not in Massachusetts, even though they look the same. Describe that. What is that about upstate New York?
That is true. I mean, on a literal level, I mean, the geology shifts. You pass down into that Hudson River Valley, and the plain essentially opens up in front of you, and the land seems to tilt toward the west instead of toward the sea. When you're in New England, the land all seems to tilt toward the sea. Once you cross that Hudson, you have a sense of being on the continent now. You're no longer out there on the edge.
To help people in those areas, just to, again, have literary references, think James Fenimore Cooper's right. Mohicans or Washington Irving's Ichabod Crane. By the way, the Hudson River School, how would you describe it? It's about darkness and what, some light coming through.
Darkness and light, and also a kind of transcendental spiritual quality to the land, where, I mean, it really goes back to Emerson in the 1840s and transcendentalism in New England. That view that the deity practically exists in the land, and this is a very American perspective on landscape, on nature, and those painters were particularly engaged by that idea. So they exaggerate the setting sun, they put in glowing color and also glowering symbolically heavy cloudscapes and
right.
so forth. Yeah,
and dark woods.
And then the human beings, whenever the human beings appear in those paintings, as they only occasionally do, they're tiny, way down in the corner.
Afraid of Ichabod Crane. Oh, it's such a great feel for upstate New York. And let's talk about the painter who's at the center of your story, who's based on a real painter and illustrator that I understand you collect, Rockwell Kent?
That's right. He was a great painter, illustrator of the 1930s, perhaps the most in the 40s, famous or one of the most famous painters in America and in the world, really. He also was a radical leftist, and I mean not just a, you know, parlor pink or a guy, a liberal, limousine liberal, but a Stalinist practically.
Did he go off and fight the Spanish Civil War as your character does?
No, he didn't, and it is therefore based loosely on Rockwell
right.
Kent. There are aspects of Kent that I was really attracted to. One is his politics and the divide that created in his life between his loyalty and his support of the poor on the one hand, and the fact that his social milieu and his audience, his collectors and so forth, were members of the elite class that his politics attacked. So he had the kind of conflict that is really not uncommon in America. It wasn't uncommon at all in the 30s and even to today. I mean, from John Dos Passos and Hemingway and Edmund Wilson to, you know, artists and writers like, you know, Tony Kushner and E.L. Doctorow and why not Russell Banks today.
Well, I want to ask you about that because what you do in your story is you throw these classes together. Jordan, the artist, flies his seaplane into the lake where a gorgeous socialite lives and her father's just died. And you enter into the story a local worker, a good man named Hubert Saint-Germain. Mm-hmm. He's a hunting and fishing guide for the rich and famous. All their lives entwine and then strangle, mm-hmm. actually. What are you saying about that tension between the local and the summer people, and particularly the artists who often move into these areas like upstate New York and try to straddle those cultures?
I don't know if I'm really saying anything about it or arguing anything. I'm trying to understand it and get to it. I am trying to describe a kind of mutual exploitation that is to the advantage, really, of the rich and powerful, an interdependent relationship that has all kinds of edges to it and problems associated with it for both sides, but most particularly for the poor.
Well, Hubert, in this case, you know, he was the expert. You know, he knew the land. They depended on him, but he doesn't own the land.
And also, it's a kind of the land, the beautiful, natural, unspoiled world up there, is for the rich and powerful a kind of fantasy, a playground, whereas it's a whole different kind and level of reality for the people who live there year-round. It's harsh and difficult. I mean, even to today, the unemployment rate in many of those small hamlets up there is in the wintertime over 20%. So it's a remarkable and striking, ironic, and painful contrast.
Do you feel that tension personally as someone? I mean, obviously you love the area, but are you seen as outsider by somebody who's, you know, trying to, and you know, eke a living out of the land?
Yeah, it's inescapable, really. No matter how long I've lived there, and my wife's family has lived there for generations, it's clear that I'm from away. My source of income is from somewhere outside the town, and that's for sure. But you know what was interesting to me? Let me go back to an earlier question when you asked, what am I trying to say here with regard to that conflict that the artist Jordan Groves experiences and exemplifies. I think what I found out, let's put it that way, I think one of the things that I was trying to understand it, and what I came out of it is an understanding that the artist really can't belong to either class or to any class. You know, we like to think in America that an artist can move through any class. But the fact is, to be an artist, you almost can't belong to any class. You've got to stand just outside. And it almost goes with the territory.
Hmm. Russell Banks, by the way, we had one last question. Do you read reviews?
I actually do occasionally. When they come my way, I don't seek them out, and they do come my way.
You got a rave from the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
They write, "The Reserve may well be the best and darkest work of fiction written to date about the storied region of high peaks, glacial lakes, and vast forests." So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Then,
then I woke up one morning.
And you were, as they call it, kakutanied. Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times, let's just say, was not as happy with the book.
No.
How dizzying is that for an author?
It felt like a stick in the eye for about 2 hours, and then I reread it. And then it seemed funny in a way because it was so over the top. But, you know, I'm in such good company that I felt good about it after I thought about it for a little while. She savaged Joyce Carol Oates, Don DeLillo, Martin Amis, Doris Lessing, Philip Roth. It's a pretty good group of writers to be in the same company with. But the thing with reviews for a writer is that you don't learn anything from a really good review about your own work and how to proceed from here. And you don't learn anything from a really bad review about your work and how to proceed from here. Obviously, it makes a big difference in how the sales go. I mean, it has an economic impact. But from the writer's point of view, it's really not as important as it is to the publisher.
If someone like Kakutani calls your book a cheesy histrionic novel, well, you are here, Russell Banks, because we're leaning towards the other review. It just makes you feel the region that many of us love so well.
What was it? Someone said, "A bad review can ruin my breakfast, but I refuse to let it ruin my lunch."
Russell Banks, the book is The Reserve. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me here.